It is written in the Proverbs, "In the fear of the Lord is strength, is strong confidence, and his children shall have a place of refuge." And also in the Psalms, "The Lord will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. And they that know thy name will put their trust in thee. For thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee." The truth of these scriptures and their power for good in the lives of all the saints of God is well amplified in the experiences of Moses throughout his life. And now the least in those experiences of which we have read this morning, and inasmuch as Moses is commanded to go as an example of living faith, we must necessarily see those readings as a source of strong confidence and secure refuge in these present days of evil. The scriptures encourage us to see our calling and involvement with the Almighty as something real and purposeful, certainly not so dramatic as in the case of Moses, but still a matter of reality, and calling into play the same principles as were brought out in God's dealings with him. We have read of the making known to Moses that of memorial name of the Almighty, expressive of his purpose, of God's manifestation. Most human organizations exist for the purpose of man's manifestation in the form of another, in a form or another, but it cannot possibly be so amongst the true servants of God. God, his ways, his thoughts, his principles are to be manifested primarily in his Son, Jesus Christ, and in all who are to form that glorious company of the redeemed. No other in the finality of things will have any abiding place. Our calling in Christ has as its object in the course of probation the achievement of those aims. Christ, whom we remember at the table, was the firstborn of that new creation, and he has set the pattern to which all his true brethren and sisters from all ages of human history are to be conformed. Paul, in writing to the Romans, as we were reading yesterday, said, "For whom he, God, did forsake, foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren." Accordingly, in chapter 12 of that same letter, Paul proceeds to exhort, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to the world." And here there comes the concept of God's manifestation as the object of probation. Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that we may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly. Here in these words is the clear repudiation of all that the organizations of this present world stand for. Man's manifestation, instead there is to be that transformation, metamorphosis a complete change of aim and outlook, that the servant of the Lord may in truth become conformed to the image of his Son. The exhortations which stem from their matter are all embracing upon every aspect of our present lives, our speech, our actions, whether in the home, in the ecclesia, or in the world, or as we go about our daily occupation. Above all, they are principles that should govern our very thoughts, since these are the determinative factors of all that we do and say. So the pharmacist says and wrote, "The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts." In those words, we can readily see enough the assertive man-manifested ways of the present evil world, in which we have to move, and we ourselves are certainly not always immune from the disposition to think and to act in a similar way. This is the way of the natural man, that God is not in all his thoughts. Yet, if such be our thinking, or perhaps the implication and the consequence of our thinking, what do we mean then? What do we more than others? Do not even the publicans the same? What is it then that is manifested in our own thoughts? What thoughts are they which find expression in our words and deeds? It is the confidence, assertive, cocksure manner, manifested manner of unreconciled mankind, or is it rather the mode of thought and action which manifests the name and the principles of the Almighty? Yet, if such be by our thinking, or perhaps the implication and the consequence of our thinking, what do we do more than others? That is the way in which we have been called. God's manifestation, it is the way in which we have been amplified in Christ. In ample measure, it is seen also in Moses, of whom we are currently reading. Moses, the man of God, in his thoughts, as they are here manifested, and his work and mission, there was to be seen the principle of God's manifestation. He did not invariably speak and act advisably, but his heart was certainly in the right place. Moses at the burning bush in some ways present a contrast with the Moses of 40 years previously, when, as Stephen put it, seeing one of his brethren suffering wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian, for he supposed his brothers would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. Those 40 years in Midian had brought about a maturing and a mellowing of the character of Moses. And now at the burning bush, there was none of that former eagerness to act immaturely, but rather it was, as we have read, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" If we are rightly exercised by the experience of probation, the effect must always be to diminish considerably that self-confidence and cocksureness that goes hand in hand with inexperience. Speaking generally, it is notably that a man's self-confidence and self-assurance is invariably proportionally to his express, to experience and maturity. The heart may be, the heart may well be in the right place. There may be commendable enthusiasm, but these things in themselves are not enough. The more a man becomes mellow and matured by experience, the more clearly he comes to realize that his own ideas and thoughts, as the thoughts and the ways of the natural man, are not to be relied upon. Who is there among us of middle age or old age who does not have to admit that if we were given our life to go through again, we would want to do many things differently from the way in which we did do them? It has been said that experience keeps the expensive school, but fools will learn in no other. Yes, such is our natural disposition as sons of Adam, that we sometimes refuse to learn except by experience. The way of the natural man is to be impetuous and forward and assertive, as we see in the world around us. And almost invariably, the self-impetuousness and the self-assurance are inversely proportionate to the amount of true understanding and maturity. For 40 years, Moses had lived a life of obscurity in Midian, and now he would have been quite willing to remain as obscure as he could be, had not he had no ambition to be anything else. Thus we have his words in the to the Almighty, which we have read this morning. Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? Then later, oh my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, not since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of slow tongue. This self-assessment by Moses may well have been correct. There's nothing in the narrative to suggest otherwise. Yes, but God always has made use of men who lack those qualities in which the natural man glories. Men everywhere admire an eloquent man, one who has the right word for every occasion, but such are not needed by God, at least not for their natural eloquence. Of Paul the Apostle, it was said that his bodily presence was weak, and his speech contemptible, and yet to him it was proclaimed, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." It always has been the policy of the Most High to make use of things and people that are of little amount in the eyes of the natural man. And yet it is significant that, however lacking Moses may have been in eloquence among his fellows, he was always eloquent enough to pray to God, especially the private prayer. In which form of eloquence are we at our best? In speaking to men and among men, or speaking to the Almighty in prayer? But then there came the assurance from God, "Certainly I will be with thee." Lack of self-reliance in carrying out the appointment of God is a good thing, but not lack of faith. The Lord chided Moses for making all excuses, and because his excuses were not true, but for a seeming lack of confidence in God, who had called men to be participants in the outworking of his purpose. God's manifestation, Paul could say, Notwithstanding his weakness and supposed feebleness of word speech, I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. These matters are appropriate to our own consideration in regards to the work of whatever kind we may try to do in the service of the Lord. Do we tackle such work because, although recognizing our limitations, we see that it is the Lord's work and that he has promised to be with and to bless those who approach the work in such spirit as that? Or is it because rather we think we are entitled to some recognition in the ecclesia, perhaps even in the extent of voting for ourselves in the ballot? Yes, on the other hand, it should be remembered that distrust of oneself is a good thing, but only so if it leads to trusting God and to depending on him. Not so if the self-mistrust leads to paralysis and inability and unwillingness to undertake any form of service of God. But God gave to Moses those miracles and signs, and he was assured, if God would be with him, he would undertake the commission. The rod, his shepherd's staff, was cast upon the ground to become a serpent. Likewise with ourselves, although we have no miraculous signs, God can still take hold of the things of our everyday experience and turn them to the furtherance of his work. All our common everyday possessions are his, and we are but the stewards of that which belongs to the Almighty. When we consider the natural reluctance of Moses to undertake the work and his very real feelings of insufficiency, his acceptance of the task must surely be seen as an act of great faith. He felt himself by natural aptitudes to be utterly unfitted for the duty, and yet because God required it of him, because prompted him, proposed to him, Moses would lean and rely upon God entirely. With such a man as that, God could work. And thus it came about in the case of Moses that in the fear of God was strong confidence and a place of refuge. Having received that commission, Moses lost no time in getting to work. Promptly he sought his release from the service of Jethro, leaving behind practically all his possessions, again an act of great faith. And we record the words of the Lord, whom we remembered at this table. Whoever he be that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. It seemed that there had been neglect to circumcise one of the children of Moses, and apparently, reluctantly, Sisera performed that which was required. Sisera, there was no true fear of the Lord, only resentment and an apparent sullen compliance. In those circumstances, there could be no true harmony. And so in this incident, we are reminded of two important matters governing our acceptability of God. There is a need for readiness and willingness to meet all his requirements without demur. Yes, we cannot presume merely to go so far and to stop of complete submission to God and think that the rest will necessarily be forgiven because of that which we have done and complied with. We may, if we are so minded, make an outward show of submitting to it, but without that spiritual circumstances of that commission of which the scriptures speak. Paul shows the relationship of those matters in the purpose of God's manifestation. To the Colossians he wrote, "For in him, in Christ, dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. He is the center that is of the great purpose of the Almighty, to reveal himself through man. We are associated with it through membership of his body. Yet a membership which entails the acceptance of the same principles of faith and obedience that Christ himself manifested in his mortal life. That is the condition and the implication of our membership of him. Now, put like that, as the inspired word does put it in the letter to the Corinthians, to the Colossians, it makes some of our professed subjections seem very puny and half-hearted. Yet this is undoubtedly the standard in which we are called. It is that which was amplified in Moses with his faithfulness in God's house and his meekness, his subjection of all self-esteem, even perhaps to a fault when there was set almost against the invitation and the assurance of the Lord. But when God calls, as he called Moses and calls us now through his potent and effective word, God does not act without wisdom or intelligence. Surely he knows what he is doing, and he called. And he and his call and invitation must always be seen as an indication that all who are so called to be associated with his purpose are capable of bringing to fruition that which God has promised and proposed. To think otherwise or to act in a way that denies the truth is to charge God with unwisdom, with folly, with inconsequential action. And as Paul elsewhere says, God is not mocked. Men do in effect mock him when acting in defiance of what he has said and in disbelief of what he has promised, or is unwilling to accept his invitation. In our small community, much that happens hinges upon what commonly are called human relationships, sometimes almost to the point that the purpose and object of ecclesial existence may seem to become obscure. It is easy to get to the state of mind in which the little world of ecclesial association becomes an end in itself and not a means to the end God has appointed. And when that happens, there is further the tendency to assume and take for granted that all the methods of the great world outside are relative to our little world of ecclesia existence. All their planning and scheming, their devices, schemes to achieve their own ends, their little tattling gossips about one another's business and affairs. All this can so readily come crowding in and intruding upon the ecclesia scene. All of it taken together, forming a picture which is tedious and banal in the extreme. The truth in which we have been called, and in captain and leader whom we remember here, are greater and far more worthy of attention than all that, as we compare our calling with that of faithful Moses and all those faithful ones who are commended in the letter to the Hebrews. Surely we are not compelled to lift up our heads in more sense than one, not only because the promised redemption draws nigh, but equally so as we were to lift our sights above the petty trivialities of human relationships, to rejoice in the truth itself for our own sake. We have sung of that this morning. We lift our hearts. These seeking for grace, in reality, we ought to be here only for the truth and not for engrossment in small matters of petty strife and rivalry and the likes. Some amongst the Corinthians were like that, and Paul rebuked them for having like children and babes. So Paul, again, in writing to the Colossians, gives us the appropriate exhortation in the light of the example, not only of Moses, but also of faithful Israelites. Faithless Israelites and obscure, stubborn Pharaoh. If we then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things on the earth, for ye are dead, not only circumcised in Christ, but dead in him, dead to all that characteristics the outside world which has we profess to have left behind, with all its manifestations, and your life is hid with Christ in God. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. To do that is the object of our entire probation. Christ did it in perfection. Now we remember him in fellowship with him and with the Father.